let's begin.
Indeed.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Honey Badger Radio. My name is Brian, and this is the Fireside Chat, and I am here with Clary Jackson. Clary Jackson operates a website and blog over at socialtheorywatch.org and a YouTube channel, which is also called Clary Jackson, where she discusses lawfare, feminist legal theory, false allegations, historical allegations, moral panic, and lots more. So welcome to the Fireside Chat, Clary Jackson. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, it's been a long time coming. We've been talking, a little bit, like a couple of years ago, and then you responded, and I, for whatever reason, I never got your email, and then you gave me another poke, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, I remember this person. and this is just the way things go, because I email so many people, and most of them I don't get responses from, particularly when I email feminists, which I do all the time. Most of the time they don't respond to me, but
surprise, surprise.
Yeah. So, you know, when I don't get a response from someone, it's easy for me to forget to kind of follow up with them and see if they're still interested. And I assume that they're not unless they email me back. So, but we did get it working and I'm really glad to have you on. I enjoy your content quite a bit. So, can I ask you a couple of questions? Cause I'm not really up on my legalese. So what is lawfare? What is that?
Lawfare. It's basically a weaponization of the legal system to get back at somebody.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. So I just wanted to know what that meant right off the bat. So here's the thing I wanted to ask you, though. Why did you decide you wanted to talk about this stuff? Like, what got you involved in this discussion?
Geez, where do I start? Well, let's just say before I got involved in this, I was a very different person leading a very different life. And I was, leading a, happy-go-lucky life for the most part, involved in all sorts of things. But then I met somebody in about 2013 or late 2013. And we hit it off right away. And as we got to get to know each other, I found out that he had been involved in the legal system and that he was criminally convicted for a sex crime. And it was like, oh, really? Okay. So,
just kind of came out like he I'm assuming it's a he just told you this.
Yes. Okay. It didn't come out like, oh, by the way, today's Sunday, it wasn't like that easy. It was just, he was involved in some things and, it was obviously a very delicate conversation and it was kind of awkward, but we were in a private setting, so we were able to have this conversation and I was able to kind of help him talk about it. And in his mind, he felt like there was still an opportunity to have his case tossed out at that point. And of course, I didn't understand how the legal system worked. I'd never been involved in it and I'd never known anybody who was involved in it to that extent anyway. And, so we talked about it, it was like, okay, so you were convicted. So like there must have been proof, right? That was my first thought, just like anybody else would think. And the fact that he was arrested and charged, well, obviously there must have been proof. So as we talked about it, he started feeding me the transcripts that he had for his case. And he was like, do you want to read this stuff? And I said, yeah, if you don't mind me reading it, because it's such a serious issue and it's very personal, I'm happy to read it and try and understand. And so I did. And as I was reading the judge's decision and the transcripts from the police statements and things, I kept looking for the smoking gun, page, turn, where's the smoking gun? And I'm finished reading everything and there's no frickin' smoking gun. So right then I'm like, okay, why are you charging and arresting people, prosecuting and convicting people when there's no evidence of this claim? There's nothing to back up this claim.
Right.
And so I started just intently researching this. And in the judicial decision of his case, there were a lot of legal precedents that were cited. And so I just decided to research them. And I found Ken Lee, which is our Canadian database of all of our case law and legal decisions and legislation. Mm-hmm. And I started learning. I just started piecing stuff together and started learning. And ultimately, all roads led to feminism.
Hmm.
Then I started learning about feminism because I was never really a feminist. I mean, by virtue of living in Canada, I may have had some feminist threads embedded within me, right? You know? Mm-hmm. But as far as actual feminist legal theory and things like this, I had no clue about. So I got on the internet, and as I started researching, I saw that there was a lot of content online on Twitter and on YouTube making fun of feminists and then yeah. social justice warriors. And I thought, okay, yeah, like this, okay, that makes sense. These memes make sense. But then I started noticing how ingrained feminist legal theory is in our legal system. And that was, that's when I put the concept together that the general social theory is that feminism is a joke and nobody pays any attention to feminists.
Yeah.
But then I realized it's no joke.
I agree.
It's actually, it's already destroyed our legal system.
Mm-hmm.
So it just went from there, and I decided to start with a Twitter channel, a Twitter account. And then I started just like voraciously consuming YouTube videos like yours, Honey Badger Radio. And I thought that was like the name was just so cool because I'm like, I'm a honey badger, you know? you know, my relationship with this man who, you know, started all of this began to develop and flourish. And I became his staunch supporter and pretty much his only supporter. Because a lot of people fell off the wayside believing that because he was convicted, there must have been some truth to the claims.
Mm. And, wow. That's yeah. quite a journey.
Yeah.
And so I want to go back on a couple things. So how does all of your research, how did it connect from these sort of legal cases? How did that connect to feminism? Like, how did you find that that's where it always went?
Wow. Oh, that's a good question. It's digging back in the memory banks to particular things. I guess it started with an organization called LEAF. They kept popping up a lot. LEAF, and they're, it's an acronym for Legal Education and Action Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that they are basically a lobbyist activist legal foundation that specifically litigates cases for women. So I discovered that they have, they intervene in a lot of cases that ended up changing the legislation and Supreme Court of Canada decisions and directing them towards favoring women when it comes to either being believed in the courts or letting them go and letting them, freeing them from killing their lovers or their husbands or their babies, infanticide. And I discovered that LEAF came about, they organized at the same time that we melded our Charter of Rights and Freedoms with the Constitution in 85 or around there. And at the same time that happened, they were also lobbying to remove the corroboration requirement from the criminal code. And that was something else that I, you know, that was another dot. And the corroboration requirement is basically you needed, you know, physical evidence to verify and validate that there's some truth to the claim before it can go to court or before it can result in a conviction. Well, they had that repealed. Feminists lobbied for that, and it was repealed from our criminal code. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with the statute of limitations. That was repealed, which means anybody can come forward and say, he raped me 25 years ago. Well, obviously, 25 years ago, you're not going to have any evidence or hardcore proof, any material or physical evidence that can prove or even disprove that claim. So with that, the innocent accused person is at a major disadvantage.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm looking up. I looked up Leaf while you were giving me that great answer, and I want to share a little bit of this with the audience because I think it's important and really interesting. Before I do that, I want to let the audience know. Please hit the like button. It does wonders for our analytics. It gets more people that might become interested in checking out the stream. So please do that. And if you have any questions for Ms. Jackson, just give us a super chat, and I will be glad to read it out. Be sure to do that. So let me share. First, I'm going to share the website so people can see it. This is the website for LEAF, Women's Legal Education and Action Fund. Does that sound right?
Yep.
Okay, and it says, on April 17th, 1985, LEAF was founded to ensure Canadian courts protect the equality provisions in S15 and S28 of the Charter. LEAF's founding mothers created LEAF to defend the equality rights enshrined in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Over 30 years, the battles LEAF has fought in the courts have achieved many victories and advanced substantive equality for women and girls in Canada. So, basically, LEAF works to ensure that the Canadian courts do, in fact, provide the equality rights guaranteed to women and girls by Section 15 of the Canadian Charter. Our strength comes from a small team in Toronto, member branches in several provinces, scores of active volunteers who serve on committees, a national board, and West Coast LEAF in British Columbia. So that was just the about section on the website. I just thought I would share. So... And I think, is this where we get into, so this is basically the seemed to be a common thread through like a lot of these cases that you looked at, and you said that LEAF pops up multiple times. Is this where this feminist legal theory comes in that you, you also sort of discuss on your channel?
Because in order to create a legal precedent through the Supreme Court of Canada, typically, it's done by an intervener, mm-hmm. which is a third party that has an interest in the outcome of the case. And it's often when it comes to sex crimes or crimes against women and or children, you'll often find LEAF on the list of interveners.
Ah, I see. And what is feminist legal theory? Like, how does it differ from regular legal theory?
Well, yeah, okay. So basically, feminist legal theory is that women and girls and children, women are children, that's one. Mm-hmm. And the other one is mainly that they are at a disadvantage, mm-hmm. and that they need equality, substantive equality. And in order to do that, we need to strengthen the laws and giving them more rights and basically giving them special privileges due to the classification that we've given them being a minority or an underprivileged group, a class, right? A protected class.
Sure.
So they do that by essentially removing due process because in their minds, the due process that existed for hundreds of years within our common law legal system creates an unfair advantage to the women and children who are making the complaint.
Mm-hmm. And in the transcripts for your the person the person that you are care about so much and from your history that got you involved with this, in the transcripts, did the judge explain why he was going to be convicted? Even if there was no smoking gun, was there some, I want to know what the logic was, if any at all, even if it doesn't make any sense, but I'd like to hear it.
Okay. It was a female judge, by the way. Mm. Doesn't necessarily mean that she's always going to rule.
It shouldn't matter.
It shouldn't matter, but just as a side note, mm-hmm. anyway, the prosecutor was a staunch feminist though. That I know for sure. She's a troll too, but anyway, I won't name her, but she's about, 5 feet tall and fat. So she literally.
Oh, you mean a literal troll, not just like a lol, kill yourself troll. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so basically the judge, what she did was there was since there was no evidence to prove anything, she used a statement that he had made to the police. And the statement, I won't go into it, but ultimately it was a post-offense issue. So mm-hmm. it was something that he had made, he had contradicted himself on. And the thing is that statement that he made had nothing to do with the claim that was against him. It had nothing to do with the actual crime that they claimed he committed. It was just that he told a little lie while he was talking to the police. And therefore, she decided that that within itself put a pall all over all of his evidence. That was one thing. And but at trial, he admitted to it. He didn't, you know, try and continue with it or anything like that. He just said, yeah, I told that lie. But, you know, mm-hmm. I did it for a totally different reason that's completely unrelated to this case. And the other thing was that there were statements that he made during the police statement that she took out of context and interpreted it in a way that the Crown interpreted it. So the Crown interpreted it in a way where the judge twisted what he was saying and took it out of context.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I see a lot in overturned convictions. This is a very common thing where the Crown will actually summarize all of the evidence heard at trial, but make a lot of errors, mm-hmm. and then submit it to the judge. And then the judge just uses that summary when they're coming to their decision making process. Without the judge doesn't actually go through the trial transcripts to verify and confirm what the prosecutor is putting in front of them. And that happened in his case as well. So those were the two things. That was
crazy.
Pretty much it.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's like I assume that you're supposed to have due process like we do in the United States, right? Innocent until proven guilty. The preference to make sure that, you know, how does the saying go? If it's best to let, 100 men go free than put one innocent person mm-hmm. in prison.
Yeah.
I assume you guys work from that. You're supposed to work from that same assumption, but this kind of activist legal practice, it's pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
And he did go to prison. How long did he serve? How bad was it?
2 years.
He was there for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I assume it affected his ability to find work and probably also like relationships.
It affected
too.
A lot of things.
Yeah. I mean, if you didn't bother to look into this story more, you could have just saw that as a red flag and immediately ran for the hills, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I guess you probably wanted to at one point, or maybe you had the inclination. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but was there a moment where you were like, ooh, maybe this isn't a good idea? Or
yeah, well, I wasn't invested in any relationship at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely had it wouldn't have been difficult. And, you know, there was like no reason for me not to run away. But the way I saw it, I felt like this was a terrible injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And I became invested. I became obsessive, really, over the case.
Do you work in the legal industry at all? Because based on your video content, it sounds like you do, like you're a paralegal or something. But
no, my professional background is IT project management,
mm-hmm.
Web applications and software development. That's my professional background. I consider myself sort of an accidental legal scholar or student.
Yeah.
Because now I kind of speak in legalese nowadays, but I think that's because I've read so many judicial decisions. I've spent so many hours in Can Lee. I just read and read, and I talk to lawyers because I became involved in his case as it went on.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of meetings with the lawyers and sitting in on hearings and trying to make sense of what was happening before me, because he didn't have any clue what was going on.
Right.
No clue. He was too busy trying to make money to pay the lawyers.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate enough to be able to have the time to kind of go, here, let me take the stuff and see if I can work with your lawyer to try and, you know, take this to the next step with some level of control, right? Without just leaving it in the lawyer's hands and not really know what's going to happen. Because that's a problem, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, you know, I was just thinking about this. Like, it's almost like if you would have met him before this had happened, you probably could have helped him with the case. And just the way that you go through God, this, yes. It could have changed everything.
Guilt.
Probably.
I have guilt for that. Yeah.
For not meeting him earlier.
Yes. It's true.
Really? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess she's lucky to have you now. So that's for sure. You know. But so you said before you met him and you got involved with this stuff, you were basically like your average happy-go-lucky normie that was just doing her thing in the regular world. How much has getting involved with this conversation, how much has that changed your life? And not just in terms of, like, you know, how you go about your day and how you see the world, although I want to hear that stuff, but even like personal relationships and professional relationships and these kinds of things. How much has it changed everything for you?
It's changed a lot. I don't even log into Facebook anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really hang out with my friends much anymore. The friends that I had before. I suddenly realized that a lot of my friends are these social justice warrior type of people, but like, they don't know it. They're not trying to be social justice warriors. They they're just going along with the general theory, you know, like the school of fish theory, right? Everybody's going in one direction. So they all go in the same direction because there's protection in that and there's safety in that. And I kind of stepped out of that school of fish and see things in a whole different new perspective now. And I find myself educating people a lot of the time when I have the opportunity. And when we do go see friends, and when I do talk to my friends, the close friends that, you know, are still friends, even through all of this, you know, I just take the opportunity to educate people now because I feel like it's my duty to say, hey, you think that things are this way, but actually, if you really want to know and if you really care, you should understand that things are actually this way. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't believe everything that you read or hear or automatically jump to the conclusion that because somebody's been accused of something, that it's true, or that somebody's been convicted of something, that there was evidence to prove that they were guilty, because there isn't always, that's not always the case.
Mm-hmm.
So I find myself having a lot of intense and uncomfortable conversations. And I feel like I'm an educator, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. I lost a lot of friends getting involved with this, although I gained some too.
Yeah, and you gained new friends.
Yeah, and I found my wife through this too. So, you know, I'm grateful for that. It's good. It's you know, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. Like, it's good because you know, you do the work, and I feel like I'm closer to all the truths. And at least now I know what I'm looking for, and that is the truth. And it's not just in gender things, but in all areas. And I know who to be skeptical of, and it is difficult because, you know, I think that the kind of social justice narrative, even if it's mild, I think that's in most people because they want to be compassionate and they want to say that they care about protected groups and, you know, and all that. And they just don't see how there is so much overreach and how, you know, there's so much rewriting of history, re-envisioning history just creates this. It's like the, you know, not to be too cliche, but it's like that cave, the Socrates cave, you know, that people always talk about where you have like the shadows in front of the fire that people are watching, but they think it's real, but it's not real. Mm-hmm. And it can be challenging to but little by little, you know, I work on people and some people don't want to talk to me anymore. And yeah, that can be tough. So
but it's not going to change my perspective.
No. And it's, yeah, like I said, I did the work. So, you know, I know that I'm not coming from the position of I'm just like taking on these views because I like them.
Or in conspiracy fact, theory type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. So you, so this, how, as far as the legal stuff, I see you've been making a lot of videos about this. Mm-hmm. In Canada, how deep do you think, would you call this corruption, first off? And if so, how deep would you say it goes?
I would call it noble cause corruption, which is a known and documented number, top cause of wrongful convictions within our justice system.
Mm-hmm. And how deep would you say that goes? How serious do you think it is?
I think it's pretty serious because I've actually counted the number of overturned convictions between for a five-year period, and I've documented all of these overturned convictions just in sex cases, sex crime cases. And there are, I found that there were on average about 20 of them per year. And these are just the convictions that get overturned. So 20 per year, I think, is way too high of a number, especially since it's consistent, which means nobody's learning from the last case.
Right. Yeah. And so it just sort of repeats. Yeah. It repeats itself because people don't learn from before. And I think it seems like to me, like here in the United States, we have this thing called when it comes to you deal with false allegations. I guess I should ask this first. Are these like sexual assault, rape, this kind of thing? Sexual harassment? Yeah. Not necessarily domestic violence, but do you also look at those things too?
No, I'm more interested just in the sex crime, particularly the historical ones where people go to a therapist's office with depression and substance abuse, and then they come out months later with newfound memories of being raped by their babysitter or their brother. This is a very common occurrence, which nobody likes to talk about. So I'm kind of one of those people that will, you know, I'll make content on that because it is an issue. There's a lot of influence around sex crime claims. So
and
that's what I focus on.
Okay. Of the overturned cases, do you know what the, like what the ratio, the percentage of total cases that's affecting, or is it just like a high number of overturned cases?
Which, like what's
20,
affecting?
20 overturned cases from out of how many, I guess is what I'm saying.
Oh, like how many actual sex crime cases? Okay. Mm-hmm. So per year, there's about, I think, 3,500 that go to trial.
Mm-hmm. So 20 out of 3,500?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Still, that's a lot. But yeah, that was the thing I was wondering about. Michael Keller asked, and I thought I would ask for him, even though he couldn't afford a super chat. But I thought it was a good question. So I went ahead and asked it. Because here in the United States, we have the Duluth model. That's why I was asking about the domestic violence. Are you aware of the Duluth model?
Yes, yes.
And you know, yeah, so that's like, for those of you guys who don't know, that is a model that is practiced in most, if not all, of the 50 states. And it's the way in which the legal system handles a domestic violence or domestic disturbance situation. And it basically starts from the assumption that the man is the problem, even if the woman is the abuser, and the man has to be essentially separated from the situation. So it operates under a feminist theory, a feminist approach to dealing with domestic violence, which essentially assumes the man is the aggressor in all cases, or he is on some level responsible in most cases. So and I thought you maybe, because I don't think you guys have the Duluth model by name, because you don't have a Duluth, Minnesota, but maybe you have something similar. And I thought feminist legal theory sounds like it probably incorporates that and other stuff. So
yes. Oh, yeah. No, I know that the Duluth model, in essence, is definitely incorporated in our law. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And have you noticed, I don't know if you look at stuff recently, but this Me Too movement, which is the big new thing where a lot of women are coming out with allegations, the high profile ones, which usually involve celebrities. So it's hard to say, you know, because they make up such a small percentage of people in general, as well as a small percentage of people making, I guess you could say, Twitter allegations. But the Me Too movement has a lot of people making allegations that are 10, 20, or 30 years old in some cases. Do you think that is creating more, like, are you seeing more cases that may come out as a result of the Me Too movement? Like there are women coming forward or anything like that? Is there some side effect of this?
I think it's been having a really perverse effect in creating this perception that women haven't made the claim for X amount of years because they were afraid that they wouldn't be believed. But what we're seeing is that when they do go make the claim, the men are getting arrested, charged, and in some cases tried and convicted, mm-hmm. like Bill Cosby, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey Weinstein. I mean, look, he's got a trial coming up, and I've been watching that. And there's been tons of evidence that have come out in his favor that has shown that these women are basically putting on a show, right?
Yeah. So, well, they consented to something, and right. they went along with it because he promised to boost their careers.
And so, now so it's having this perverse effect of saying, you know, oh, us poor women, we won't bother going to the police because, you know, they'll never believe us. But maybe if we have the entire social media world behind us, maybe we'll get an arrest and a charge and oh my God, there was a conviction. Oh my God. It's like, yeah, the laws have been in place for 30 plus years in the U.S. and in Canada where no corroboration is required. You can believe the testimony of the complainant and that's sufficient to convict.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the surprise here? What's perverted is that it's lawfare. It's obvious lawfare.
Mm-hmm.
It's an obvious weapon that women are just coming out. Instead of using this weapon in secret, they're actually coming right out and being celebrated, wielding this deadly blunt force weapon against any man they think deserves it.
Yeah. Or maybe they just feel vindictive, or maybe they're looking to get payola, you know, or whatever. It could be for any number of reasons. And the fact exactly. is that there's no accountability for false allegations. That nope. they can and because it's been so long, they could say, oh, I guess I had, you know, a weird episode of, I don't know, a psychological episode, and I guess nothing really happened. Like they could, in theory, do that. And yeah, it ruins people. It really does. And mm-hmm. we know what the really sad part is that there are people that I've seen, you know, that are a lot of people who are commentators on this stuff that I have a lot of respect for. I think they're smart. And they still believe a lot of these allegations. They believe that Harvey Weinstein is guilty, you know, and they normally would side in favor of due process. Or on the other end of it, I know that Bill Cosby was actually convicted, but there's a guy who I had on the show before. He's a lawyer or ex-lawyer. He used to work for the White House, and his name is John Davis. He's great. And he made a very strong case as to why Bill Cosby was innocent, and he was just taken. Essentially, this was a modern-day lynching, is how mm-hmm. he describes it. I don't know what you think about that. I don't know if you've looked closely at the Cosby case or mm-hmm. the Weinstein case, but... what do you think about what I just said?
Yeah, I think it's a shame that if you really look deeply at the transcripts and the statements, the claims being made, the defenses being made, and if you use a rational mind and you start from the place that the man is innocent and he always gets the benefit of the doubt, mm-hmm. then you have to come to the conclusion in these cases that there simply isn't enough evidence to prove the actual claim. And that there was simply not enough proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed the crime. And if the bar is set so low that the only proof you need is a testimony, is mm-hmm. a statement, because mm-hmm. evidence or testimony is also evidence. the words are interchangeable in the legal world.
Right.
So if that's all you need, how can you prove that the crime happened? And if you get a conviction based on that, I'm sorry, but the proof was not there. To me, he might have been convicted, but he was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty.
Right. And the problem with that, and this is the saddest part, is that because he was convicted, everyone will assume that because of that, he must be guilty, because they make the appeal to the judge as an authority and say, well, he ruled, you know, against them, so it must be true. He must have done it. Maybe there's stuff we don't know that he knows, this kind of thing. And it's unfortunate, because all it shows is that all you need to do is organize enough women willing to come forward and make the accusation. Because essentially what most people...
No matter how crazy they are.
No matter how crazy they are, no matter how crazy the allegation is. Because in the case with Bill Cosby, the only reason... And Harvey Weinstein, I think these are two really good examples. The only reason why people think it's true is because of the number of people who have come forward to say something. And that doesn't prove anything, except a bunch of people came forward and said something.
And that's actually a legal principle, hearsay or prior consistent statement. Just because something is being said and repeated multiple times, even if it's by another person, still does not prove the truth of that claim.
Mm-hmm.
That's a legal principle.
Yeah. Yeah, but well, that makes perfect sense, because you could just get, it's sort of like, the witch trials. All you need is more people to come forward and say, yes, I saw her dancing in the woods naked. You know, she must be a witch. I mean, that's all you need is enough people to say it. And that's not the legal system of a free Western nation. So
that's not the legal system I thought we had. I was raised in, in an environment being told that we have the greatest justice system in the world. There might be occasional mistakes, but only in very, very serious cases. Like, oh boy, was I wrong about that.
Yeah. So do you have any, like, since you do look at a lot of cases, do you have any, like, extra crazy ones that you can share, like a story?
Oh, wow. There's just so many of them. Let me think.
No problem.
I guess, I don't know. I just highlighted one recently on my one of my live streams, and that was about a photographer who connected with a model online where photographers and models connect. And they agreed to do a photo shoot in his condo. And she tried coming on to him. And he was like, no, I have a girlfriend and you got a boyfriend. No. And then she kind of left in a huff, but nonetheless, he still escorted her to an awaiting taxi to make sure she got home safely, and made arrangements to have her pick up the photographs in a few days.
Yeah.
Seems pretty benign. Well, the next 14 months later, the police come knocking on his door, charging him with sexual assault for that night. And apparently what had happened was the girl... The night she left, she went home to her boyfriend's house and decided to send an anonymous email to the Toronto police telling them that she was raped, but did not give them any other information about herself other than his name and address. And she fully expected that the police would just go get him and she wouldn't have to be any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't hear anything. Nothing happened for several months. And then the police, I guess, checked their junk box. I don't know. Found the email and then decided to contact her. And it turned into a criminal case. And he was convicted. And the judge actually used that email as corroboration that her claim was true, because she had said it in her email. And then she said it at trial, and she said it to the police. So because she said the same thing three times, that email in particular, the fact that she sent the email out the same night was corroboration, the verification of the truth of the claim.
Wow.
Yeah. So that got overturned, luckily, but not after, you know, not after destroying this poor man's life, I'm sure.
Do you think that the are there more and more overturns happening? Perhaps, you know, like, I don't know, even if there isn't due process during the case, but perhaps afterwards where they can, you know, not, because we have, there is the Innocence Project. And you know about the Innocence Project?
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't know if you guys have something like that or if or you just use the Innocence Project. Okay.
I have something to say about them.
Oh, yeah. Well, please. I saw you're chuckling. So, yeah, go ahead. Let's hear it. I want to hear it.
Well, the Innocence Project in Canada, they, you know, serve the same purpose as any other Innocence Project overturning a wrongful conviction. Well, we had reached out to Innocence Canada, and our lawyer, well, I say our because, you know, I was involved in the case just as I pretty much project managed his case. So I feel like it's like our case. Right. So our lawyer felt so strongly that he was factually innocent that he, you know, offered to prepare a case and send it to Innocence Canada. Well, yeah. We got the response from them. And their response was basically that we don't have enough money to handle cases unless it's a murder case and somebody's in jail for the rest of their life and there's DNA, basically, in so many words.
Yeah.
So the other thing is that the document, that the application that he had to sign for Innocence Canada included a waiver that any compensation that in a, that that he might win out of as a result of the efforts of Innocence Canada, they would be entitled to 10% of that compensation plus legal fees. So whoa. There's an intent, a motivation, an incentive there for them to take cases. And that is basically on a scale of 1 to 10, what's the what are the chances that our client will win compensation and a lot of compensation that we will benefit from?
Mm.
So that was an extreme disappointment, a terrible disappointment.
Yeah.
So, okay, aside from Innocence Canada, what was the, oh, have I been seeing in terms of overturns?
Yeah.
Actually, yes, I have been noticing recently, Supreme Court of Canada has actually been entertaining a lot of sexual assault cases. And interestingly, each case is arguing a problem, which most of these cases have. So, like, for example, my partner's case, his case has like 12 different problems as to why he was wrongfully convicted. And Supreme Court of Canada has sort of been hearing one problem at a time recently, and they've got new ones coming up on their dockets. So I'm seeing that it's actually bringing some hope back that, you know, they're kind of forced to take these decisions, these problems seriously, and they're being put in a position where they are actually having to reconsider some of these legal precedents that judges have been using in order to convict an innocent person.
Uh-huh.
So I am seeing, in terms of that, some hope, a glimmer of hope. But I'm going to be watching them because the decisions haven't come out yet, but they are in progress.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's great. I mean, that's something. I try to see the silver lining, it looks like, a silver lining. Yeah. So do you... you made a video. I watched a few of your videos. I remember you made one. I think it was like why I do what I do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in it, you said that you basically made a list of things that you were not. And one of those things was an MRA. Now, I'm not going to try to, you know, talk you into it. I don't think that people have to call themselves anything. I don't care about that. It doesn't matter to us. But what I wanted to ask is that when you are looking at these cases, is there a pattern that might make you think that this could be a gendered issue? Or do you think this is just, are there just as many cases in which this affects women as well? Or What?
I have seen cases that affect women,
mm-hmm.
but not as many as men. But mm-hmm. there are, I would say, maybe 2 out of 20 cases are women. So it's a small number.
One in like 20?
Two in 20.
Okay, so like a 10%. 10% of them.
Yeah, that might be one and a half. That's okay. Impossible.
All right. Yeah, 15.
One or two. But yeah, there's always a case for a woman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Yeah, so it does happen. And these are these cases where it's men making a false allegation on a sexual allegation on a woman, like a false sexual assault allegation?
The ones that I've seen, no, it's other women.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of like a lesbian relationship thing. All right. I was just curious about that. And the other thing is, I want to talk about your website. So I'm going to display it for people. What do you do on your website? What is it? What's on here? I see there's blogs and anything else, like a bunch of useful info, this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's basically a brochure and, you know, a brochure for trying to encapsulate everything that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the blog, but unfortunately, yeah, I need to work on that more. There's just so much stuff in my head that it's hard for me to get organized and, you know, to like create a schedule to release a blog, release a video. It's so much work making these videos.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just having a difficult time organizing myself right now, but, yeah, so it's a showcase, an online brochure. It's evolving. It also shows, yeah, I started making t-shirts. I started a Teespring account.
Yeah.
For people who want to take a stand and, you know, wear the slogan that basically says, you know, what is it? Start by believing in innocence. Yeah. The presumption, the innocent until proven guilty is correct justice. So, sort of giving people, you know, a way to not only help support my work, but also give them a way to, you know, basically take a stand, you know, and just let people know that this is a very important issue in our society right now, and this is where I stand. And hey, if you want to talk about it, I'm open to it, right?
Yeah.
You know, and just some slogans like my liberty and security matters more than your feelings, you know, because it's a lot of these cases are some woman's pissed and she's decided he needs to go to jail. But, you know, this is a person's liberty and security we're talking about compared to her feelings.
And not just that person, but it's a precedent that could affect other people down the line.
Yeah. So people have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's showcasing that and books, reading material that I have read and that I find that you know, helped me in growing my own knowledge and understanding everything.
Yeah.
So I have links to some books that if people are very, you know, if they decide that they're very interested in this topic, they can read some of the resources and references that I draw from. And I just sort of want people to find me so that they can basically use me as or consider me as a repository of information that they can use however they want.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't own anything. I don't, you know, I'm not trying to be protectionist about my own information or things that I learn. I just feel like I need to be a repository of information that people might not know and that there's got to be different points that they can access it. And I'm trying to make it more interesting as well, because it is a very intense topic.
Oh, indeed. And these are the books. I was just displaying them. Wrongful Allegations of Sexual and Child Abuse, When Justice is a Game, Unraveling Wrongful Conviction in Canada, The Most Dangerous Branch, How the Supreme Court of Canada Has Undermined Our Law and Our Democracy, and Feminist Activism in the Supreme Court. So those are those sound like great books. I did show them to people, and definitely go to socialtheorywatch.org. I put links to all of your stuff, mainly your website, your Twitter, the Twitter for Social Theory Watch, not your personal Twitter, and as well as your YouTube channel. Well, because you're more active on the Social Theory Watch Twitter than yours, right? So that's where you put all your stuff. Has anyone ever reached out to you for, like, legal help or anything? Have you ever
Yes.
Really?
I've dealt with several people.
Oh, that's great.
I should say. Yeah.
That's great.
And yeah, I've had a couple people be either acquitted or had the charges dropped. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I've had to help them with is working with their lawyer. This is a very common, this is the root of the problem. Because
would you expand on that? This root of the problem?
Yeah. So a dude gets charged out of the blue and he's like, what the fuck? I have no idea what's happening. Pardon my language. Sorry.
It's okay. But this is Honey Badger fucking radio.
So he has no idea what's going on. Knows nothing about the legal system, right? Mm-hmm. Assumes that he's innocent. You know, I'm talking about innocent people as well, not people who are actually guilty of the crime.
Right.
I only help those people. And they reach out to me. So, and their loved ones as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so basically, you know, they're just in the state of, you know, the charges are bullshit. The complaint is impossible. And I don't understand why this is going to trial. I don't even understand why I'm in jail or my loved one is in jail. You know, the police just basically kidnapped him and threw him into jail. And he either did talk to the police or didn't talk to the police. People sometimes want to know if they should or shouldn't talk to the police, or if they've said too much and, you know, what can happen with that statement, how the courts can use it. If there is DNA evidence involved in their case, you know, they'll tell me about how the cops might ask them back a second time to get to get their DNA tested, to draw their blood or take a saliva swab or whatever. And, you know, they're like, what the hell is that all about? But their lawyer is telling them, just roll with it, man. Just roll with it. Don't worry about it. You better do it, right? But mm-hmm. they're freaking out because they're like, you know, so often what I end up doing is I hold their hand, proverbial hand, and I help them explain how difficult it is working with their defense lawyer, but how important it is that they have to participate in their own defense.
Yeah.
And if they're local, I can attend their hearings, which I will, and just basically act as a support person. And I'll help sort of translate what happened in the courtroom and in layman terms so they kind of understand what's going on or what to expect, what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give legal advice, obviously. I'm sort of trying to act, or I end up acting sort of as a translator, if you will, for the most part, and trying to help people understand what's going on and how serious it really is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting that you're pointing out that these men are often usually freaking out, or these people that you're helping, because people who have been, there is some science that suggests that people who have been falsely accused of rape or sexual assault or other sexual crimes, they go through a psychological trauma that is not too dissimilar to someone who's actually been sexually assaulted. Because it's like, you know, it's something you find so disgusting that you would never do it. And all of a sudden you're being accused of doing it and you go into this, you know, I think I would imagine, because I've never had it happen to me, an immensely stressful period where you're probably wondering if you did do it and you just didn't know, or how could somebody do this to you, or what is the world going to think of me? Because, you know, being accused of something as heinous as rape or sexual assault, and then like having to, you know, potentially put yourself on, you know, like a sex offender list or something. You know, that's just really, really terrifying stuff.
Well, I should say one of the consequences of my partner's case, as well as many other men who deal with this in Canada, mm-hmm. is they have to, a lot of times the Crowns will order and ask the judge to order a sex offender treatment behavior program.
Oh.
And what that entails by default, with some of the go-to psychologists that work in this field, is what's called there's two names for it, phallometric testing or a penile plethysmograph.
What? Okay, let's hear more about that.
What it is, it's a machine that gets hooked up to your dick.
Oh.
And it measures the circumference as they show you various materials, from completely benign things like trees and houses to sexual scenarios like naked men, women, and children, sexual positions and whatnot.
Gross.
And it will determine your sexual proclivities and deviance levels, and then make a correlation with your likelihood of recidivism to help inform the sentencing process.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have it? They don't have anything like that for women, though, right? I mean, there's no equivalent device, or is there?
No.
Okay, there isn't. All right. That, okay.
So we actually had to fight. We actually had to take that to court and make sure that he did not have to undergo that. And we won.
What is the goal of that? They just want to know
how... They're sick and perverted, twisted fucks.
Yeah, it sounds like they want to know how, like, what you're into. And they have this machine that does it. That's,
it's,
I don't
even,
what is
reliable.
That even supposed
it's
to, yeah.
Science.
Yeah, like, what is it even supposed to prove? I was going to say, it sounds like something, you know, that the Nazis would have used, like something made up, like something from a science fiction movie.
You know what its original use was for?
No.
It was during, I think it was the Cold War era or the World War II era, to weed out homosexuals.
Oh.
That wanted to become soldiers or something. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's what it started at.
Oh, yeah. Man. Well... You tell me what that is again, because I'm going to look into that. It's
penile plethysmograph.
Penile plethysmograph.
Yeah. Plethysmograph. Also known as phallometric testing.
Okay. Phallometric.
Yeah. But phallometric testing can apply to other body parts, but penile plethysmograph is very specific to the penis phallometric testing.
Okay. Well, yeah. I learned something today.
Have fun with that.
Yeah. I'll do that offline because I don't know what's going to come up if I start searching. But, well, yeah, I learned something today. Thank you for that. I guess the let me see if there's anybody who has any other questions. I think someone... did have a question. I want to go back and try to find it. So, but yeah, that's crazy. if you guys have any questions, put them in the chat. I may have missed one. So, but other than that, though, it was a good talk. I don't know if there's anything that you wanted to ask us, or any things that you want to say that I didn't ask you about that you think is important to point out?
Yeah, I guess one of the things that one of the reasons for all of this is just the fact that it's a legal industry that's been created to create a bread and butter industry because sex sells. Mm-hmm. And this is another way to make money from sex. And yeah. You can't deny that, can you? And
nope.
One of the things that I think is really disgusting is that in this process, we've created a pornographic database in our legal case law database, when you really think about it.
I do have a great question. Someone asks, Robert Michael asks, why do trained legal professionals think all of this is in any way normal or reasonable?
That's a good question.
Particularly the phallocentric testing, I think, but
well, any of this, really. Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, the level of government that has control over things like phallometric testing and putting people creating the sex offender registry, ordering that, the crowns, they all come from the same level of government, which is, I guess, you could say, bureaucratic.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be another term for it, but I don't know. Anyway, but they all come generally from the same, you know, and the, most of them are women. Okay. Mm-hmm. Somebody gave me statistics who works within the government. And I think it was actually, it was an officer at one of the provincial jails. I had to deal with them.
Yeah.
And, she actually told me something like 85% of the people that work in the jails are women.
Really?
And these are people in the office, in the administration end of it. And these are the people that make decisions on organizing parole hearings, mm-hmm. And just the treatment or any addressing any issues that the inmate may have. And, oh, man, I had so many terrible issues with it. Just trying to get a book sent to him was ridiculous. Anyway, that's a whole other story. Mm-hmm. But overall, and the Crowns are mostly feminists that deal with the sex crime cases. They're mostly feminists, not all of them, but they're there and they love these cases. And the probation officers that you deal with after you've done your jail time, they are mostly women. So yeah. All of these are all feminist women. And I have dealt with everyone on every level, including the parole hearing, the actual parole panel, feminists.
Yeah.
All levels, this particular level of our government that are making these decisions and creating these outcomes are a majority feminist, male and female, but mostly female, but yep. mostly feminists.
Yep.
And as basically the other problem is that on provincial levels, the Crowns, the probation and parole division, and the police boards are all independent of each other, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And they also can make their own policies that are not, they make their own policies. The government doesn't dictate what their policies are. They make their own policy. And they do not, by law, have to follow their own policy or any policy. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that in judicial decisions as well, where judges acknowledge that the police board or the parole board or the Crown attorney, the attorney general, they mm-hmm. all have their own rules. They have their own policies and I can't interfere with that. So let's move on to the next question.
Wow. And it's crazy because I could have sworn that feminists were just plucky underdogs with no actual political power of any kind. And exactly. They couldn't possibly create Bingo. Any change. All right. Well, yeah. So that I didn't know about that 85% number. That's that is pretty surprising, but not a whole lot. And I do know mm-hmm. that at least in the U.S., the majority of people in positions of political power are feminists, like the overwhelming majority. And even those who don't identify as feminists still believe a lot of feminist ideas. So it's almost like doesn't really matter if you call yourself one or not.
Exactly.
And so that's, you know, that's kind of where we are. So. And I wouldn't care about that really at all if it didn't influence the way in which the law and policy and administrative things are carried out. And it wouldn't, if it wasn't influenced by that ideology, but it is. So
it's actually, I call it literally a public threat.
Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense. Yeah. I think that's a good, you have a lot of great little, you know, names for things, you know, the feminist legal theory, lawfare. I don't know if you coined that, but that's a good one.
And, no, I didn't coin it.
That's a good one.
I'm just using it.
And the like you said, a literal public threat. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
just wait for my next t-shirt. We'll see what I do.
All right. Well, I don't have any more questions. And I think that this is this was a great conversation. We went for an hour. It's 5:05. So I hope that you had fun coming on. And yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed watching this content. Please go to her website, maybe buy a t-shirt, you know, give her some support. She's doing really great work. And there will be new blogs soon, she promises. But there are still great videos on the YouTube channel, lots to watch, some live streams as well, some long-form content, you know, and a lot of really interesting stuff. Like I watched one about how lawyers can sort of convince children to attest to things that never happened by using repetition, and there's like this, you know, bit of coercion, and it was really great. It was
Evolution of Feminist Theory series.
Yes, the Evolution of Feminist Theory. That's right. Mm-hmm. She knows her own videos. It's great. Yeah. So, okay. So anyway, thank you again, Clary Jackson. I want to thank you guys for watching us on this episode of the Fireside Chat. Do you want to come back on sometime if I ask you?
Of course, I'd love to.
All right, great. Well, maybe we'll have you back on when some like high profile case comes out and you've been following it closely. Like, were you following the Gian Gomeshi case? I know that's a more.
Oh, yeah. I made a video on that, too. It's called Victimhood: Trump's Search for Truth.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. I didn't watch the video, but I saw the I saw the title. And were you surprised by the verdict, the way that it turned out?
I can't remember what my reaction was. I don't remember if I was surprised or not, but it was the right verdict. And I was surprised by the Crown, because I realized the Crown in that case was not a feminist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that gave me, that was like, well, that's one of the reasons, because that was one ingredient that worked in his favor.
Yeah. Yeah. They actually cited on the side of reason and, you know, presumption of innocence and all these other crazy radical ideas. So, all right. Well, yeah, that was, like I said, there's lots of great videos there. You should go check them out. I think she's criminally undersubbed. She's only at like, what, 500 subs or something. Mm-hmm. Come on, guys, go over there and give her a sub. Give her, because she definitely does a lot of great work, and she's helped out real men, you know, in real trouble. So, please do that. Anyway, once again, thank you so much for coming on the Fireside Chat. Thank you guys for watching us. Be sure to give this video a like and also subscribe to the channel, Badger Live Streams, if you're not already. And lastly, leave us a comment and tell us what you think about this discussion. If you have any thoughts or questions, maybe Clary would go back and look at what you guys posted and respond to stuff. I don't know, like some of our viewers do that. So, okay, well then, and thanks again. Have a lovely afternoon, everyone. I'm going to go and enjoy the brand new heat that I just got installed and try to warm up. So talk to you guys later. Have a great one.